accession number 12197, reel 1.
Okay, Ernest Tompkins, reel 1. That tells everybody what we're doing. Well, Ernest, what I'd like to ask you is about your family and your parents and what they did and where they came from.
Yes, well, I can assure you. I was brought up in a little country village just outside Bristol. My father was the local plumber, working on a large estate. Now, my father's family, according to the records I have, were stonemasons and landowners. And I have the record going back to about 1625. And I've seen a map where it has the Tompkins Quarry. So they quarried their own stone. Now, of course, my father in his younger days was a Royal Engineer volunteer. A very athletic type of fellow. Well, he was apprenticed in his father's business. Actually, I think he went outside to be apprentice, but he came back and joined his father's business. But they had a little bit of disagreement. My father thought, well, this is not going to work, working with the family. So he got a job as an estate plumber, and he moved down from Cirencester to place called Almondsbury, just outside Bristol. Noel Park Estate, quite a big estate. And he was the village plumber. Well, I'll tell you my first memory, which is going back quite a long way. I would say it was in 1901. My mother was putting me to bed. And she looked through the window, and there was a big glow of a fire. She held me out to look at it. I was in her arms. She was putting me to bed. And that fire was put onto the common to celebrate the coronation of King Edward VII. And somebody had lit the fire 2 hours too early. And that's why I was able to see it. That's my first memory. Well, as I say, I went to the local Church of England school.
What age were you when you went to that school?
Pardon?
How old were you when you went to that school?
I started there at 3. We went to school at 3 in those days. We had the infant classes. There was 2 infant classes. The school was divided by movable screens. So if you had a function, you wanted the whole place thrown open, you could roll those screens at one side. So on the one side of the screen was the infant classes. You might call them nursery classes. And then, of course, you went from class 1 up to what you used to call X7. Normally 7, but you got up to end of 7, you couldn't learn any more, but they used to call it X7. So I went to that school till I was 14. Now we were living about 3 miles, I would say, from Filton Aerodrome. So aeroplanes became part of our lives, you know. When I reached the age of 14, I was apprenticed to a small engineering firm in Bristol. They employed three mechanics, and two were caught up in the army. So I was called upon almost to a man's job. But I remember so well, I used to cycle home every evening. So I had to pass the aerodrome. And during the summer, I always turned off to a side road to watch these aeroplanes. I was very fond of aeroplanes, you know. Well, when I became 14, as I say, I went to this firm. And during those my early apprenticeship years, I always took in the flight and the aeroplane every week. What aeroplane books I could get hold of. But of course we had to do plenty of overtime in those days. There was no men about, you see. And I was working from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night very often.
What, about what sort of date is this? This is before the First World War started, is it?
Oh, yes.
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 But how expensive was a copy of Flight and the Aeroplane to you as a 14-year-old? It must have been quite expensive for you to buy these magazines.
Well, no, that's the point. Hmm. I must tell you. Why I was able to do that's a good question. Now, when my father apprenticed me, my boss wanted a small premium. And my father said, I don't think you will need a premium. Being the son of him, I was able to get a bit of experience, you know, with tools and that. He said, I think you'll find them useful. So we'll start him at 4 shillings a week. Well, at the end of the first month's trial, of course, my father came from the army. He went back to the army then. At the end of the first month, my boss called me into the office. He said, I've agreed, he said, to cancel out your wages as far as the intentionally concerned. He said, I'm going to give you 10 shillings a week. Because I was becoming useful to him. So I was able, in that 10 shillings a week, to be able to buy my own flight and aeroplane. And still have a bit more from my mother. Because my brother was in the army, you see, and my father was also in the engineers. And it was a must for me to have that flight and aeroplane. Well, when I was 16, I saw an advert, applications for boys to enter the RNAS as wireless telegraphists. Now, I knew that my father had come to some arrangement with my boss not to let me go because I was indentured. They could hold me. The government at that time agreed not to take apprentices. There'd be a dearth of craftsmen after the war. So I just couldn't go. I went up to Wormwood Scrubs. In spite of all that they said, and I'll never forget it because they asked me just two questions. Before they asked me if I was at a release, they didn't know I was apprentice, you see. And one of the questions was, what is a quarter multiplied by a quarter, and what is a quarter divided by a quarter? Now, that's purely a catch question. To multiply the quarter becomes less, otherwise, to divide it, it's a quarter divided by a quarter is one, of course. A quarter multiplied by a quarter is 16th. Well, I got that right. And they said, what is a potentiometer? I remember those two questions. Well, a potentiometer, as I take it, is a thing that alters the potential of a current. Otherwise, it's an adjustable rheostat, what you like. See.
So the questions they were asking you were really very difficult. the questions they were asking you were really very difficult for...
They weren't easy, that's right.
Yeah, for the time.
They asked me what... Because I said I was interested in wireless, you see. And they said, well then, was I apprenticed? I said, yes. They said, well, who sent you here? They're a bit annoyed to think I even went there. Of course, I went in spite of everything. And they wouldn't take me. I was very upset about that, you know. Well, of course, it gave me a time to swat a little bit more about flying. And then a month or two before I was 18, I thought I wanted to beat the infantry. I wanted to get into the RAS. And I applied again. I went to Crystal Palace. And they wanted a trade test. I'll never forget it because it was a job to find tools, job to find a bench, and that. What they wanted was to file up a cube, an inch cube, to pass through an inch square hole, by the way. A neat fit, you know. Well, I suppose I was satisfactory enough. There again, they wouldn't take me because I was apprenticed.
Was the engineering company that you were apprenticed to involved in manufacturing for aviation?
No, they were general repair work. One chap specialised more on plumbing, that sort of thing. And machinery and that sort of thing, you know, around the town. Of course, it all changed, you see. For instance, lead and copper was very scarce. And, of course, in those days, there was no plastics much. It was all metal. But, as I say, there was only two of this chap I was left with. The other two were caught up in the army. So there was jobs in the evening. We could, of course, we only had gaslight in those days. There was, and
how many hours a day were you working? How many hours a day were you working?
I was about 12 hours a day. I was working overtime most nights. I should have gone to night school, but I just I had to get out to Almondsbury afterwards. I mean, it was a long day, so. I probably missed out a little bit, not going to the night school.
So when war was declared, I suppose that a number of men from the factory went to join up. Did they?
Well,
from the engineering works.
There was a conscription at 18C, compulsory, unless you failed the doctor's certificate. If you were a genuine conscience, you might get away with it, but they weren't very popular, conscientious objectors. I did know one fella. But normally, if you're in good health, you were like I was, caught up at 18. I was shattered. You know, I wanted to get in the Air Force, or a flying corps. Well, I must tell you this, but when I was home in the evenings, we had a rifle club. And I could show you little souvenirs. And that was very useful indeed. And the man that was running that rifle club was a man named Rodney, a descendant of Rodney of naval fame. And I didn't do too bad at that, shooting. And, of course, we had a carpentry class. I could make a few things at the carpentry class. That's when I could get off. I could work all hours because, as I said, there was no men around. See. Well, eventually, of course, I was called up. And I had to report to Horfield Barracks. That's in Bristol. And issued with our terrible stuff, army uniform. And I was sent to Chisholm. We marched from Swindon to Chisholm, I should think about 4 miles. and they were under canvas. So we went in just inside the gate, and of course there was a guard there, guard tent and all.
Had you been given a regiment by this time, or
no?
You were just general intake.
We were just trainees, TRBs, Trained Reserve. You've heard the old saying, we are Fred Carlow's army, the ragtime infantry. We cannot fire a rifle, so it's not going to wait. And when we get to Berlin, the Kaiser will say, Hawk, hawk, mein Gott, the bummy fly, you know. They used to sing that often enough. Well, when we arrived there, we were lined up. It was a hot June day, and I was like this. And a man came and spoke in my ear. He said, would I like a drink? Oh, I said I would. So I went with this man to have a drink. When I got back to the ranks, the chap next to me said, where did you go with that sergeant? I said, I pulled his leg a bit. I said, I just dropped into the guard tent. He said, what for? I said, have a glass of beer. He thought I was taking the mickey. But he said, who was that sergeant? I said, he was my brother. I didn't know he was there. He'd been in the army 3 years. I didn't know he was there.
So he was instructing, your brother was instructing new conscripts. Your brother was instructing new conscripts, was he?
He was, yes. He was a musketry instructor, look. So, matter of fact, he was in this guy joined up about the end of 1914. He was 3 years older than me, look. And he stayed in this country. I think he went to France about the last month. So, next day I got hold of Fred. I said, Fred, I said, what's the chance of getting to the flying corps? Oh, he said, not a hope. I said, what do you mean, not a hope? He said, no. He said, you're put here. He said, there's only one way you could get in the flying corps is to apply for commission. Well, I said, that would do. He said, what do you mean that would do? He said, you haven't got a school certificate, have you? I said, no. Well, he said, well, you're bound to have that. All right, he said, I'll have word with the CO. Well, of course, the CO said at first, he said he couldn't do anything for me because he said the applications were in, they had to be in by morning. And, of course, having no school certificate, that was that. And he said, well, look, he said, I'll get in touch with the schoolmaster. You tell him to go to the schoolmaster and he'll set him a test. He'd never done that before. So he sent me this test. I'll never forget it, Brad. I'd like to go through that again. Here I was sat on, we had three bed boards and two little trestles, you know. You only just had to give one a kick and your bed would collapse. But terrible things. And I was sat there. Actually, I hadn't got to the essay. I was doing my arithmetic. And when I started my essay, the lights out went. And I was prepared for this. I lit a candle. And the lights out had gone. Honestly, Brad, I'd never heard anything like it. The sergeant came out, the place shook. You know, it really shook. The audacity to light a candle after lights out. Well, you could imagine, can you? See? He couldn't put up with that. So I walked over to him. I said, I'm sorry, Sergeant. I should have told you what I had to do. He still wasn't impressed. I said, of course, I said, you know my brother, Sergeant Tompkins? He said, Sergeant Tompkins, your brother? I said, well, look, he said, carry on, he said, but don't interfere with the rest and put the light out when you're finished. But that wasn't it. They kept chipping till they went to sleep, you know, and I've got to write an essay. So I wrote that essay, and much to my satisfaction, my application was sent in.
By your commanding officer?
Applying to become an officer in the Flying Corps. So after about a month or so, I was told to report with a half a dozen others that had applied to Luggershaw before the Air Commodore. Oh, I'll never forget it. The Air Commodore was sat in the middle, and there was about three side of him. I think it was three. he was looking at what I had. At any rate, he said, "What are you here for?" I said, "My ambition to become a pilot, the flying corsair." "Pilot?" he said, "You're not here to become a pilot." He said, "You're to plan to become an officer. Understand that?" I said, "Yes, sir." "How old are you?" he said. I said, 18, sir. "Do you think you're old enough to be an officer and gentleman of the British Army? Of course, this is Army, mind, see." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "That'll do." And I was marched outside. You can tell how I felt. I was shattered. Well, he interviewed all of us, and nobody knew how they got on. Of course, that report was sent in to the... We only had to go and apply. The reports were sent back to the CO of the squadron concerned, the battalion concerned. So, I never forget my number well enough. The sergeant said, 3659, Private Tompkins, sir. Left turn. No, three paces forward. Left turn, quick march. And I went back in. And the difference, this was very friendly now. All that military stuff had disappeared. So the Air Commodore was like this. He said, "You're very interested in flying, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." "So I see," he said. He had my essay. That essay I called "The Use of Aircraft in Modern Warfare." I spent all night writing that. "Very good," he said. "What books have you read?" I told him. One, I think my name Barber was one of the chief ones I had at that time, see. He said, "Tell me," he said, "what makes an aeroplane fly?" "Now look, Brad, you can go to any pilot you like now. They all know what makes an aeroplane fly. But you've got to put that short and sweet. You haven't got to say, well, if you do this, you do that. You've got to just tell them straight out, see." And I think the answer I gave him impressed him. It did, I know. I said, "Air has weight that will resist motion. Flight is secured by driving through the air a plane inclined upward and forward in the direction of motion." That sums it all up. We know it's helped by cambers and that sort of thing, but that's the main principle, see. Now, if you go to a garage and ask the mechanic in there, "What is an internal combustion engine?" They know. They all know. But tell them in a few words. That's what you've got to do. I tell this man. And I said, "One that generates its power within itself." And that is exactly it, as opposed to a steam engine or air engine, see. He asked me about my father. He said, "Do you think you could manage on your pay?" He was very friendly, mine, after that, see. I said, "Well, I have to cut my cloth, sir." Quite. At any rate, eventually, he said, he'd forward my papers up to the War Office. He said, "The best of luck to you, Tompkins."
So as far as you were concerned... and the Air Commodore was concerned, your background wasn't any sort of handicap to you being an officer.
Well,
the fact that you'd come from a trade background and that you'd been apprenticed as an engineer didn't seem to signify.
I don't think... by that time, I think it was disappearing a bit. At one time... you'll go back in the old days... Estate owners, they were all these old colonels and generals and majors and captains. That was the aristocracy in those days, wasn't it? But that was disappearing after the war, especially. See. When I went to, at any rate, I'll go over the story. About a month, I suppose it would be. Oh, no, in this case, a week or so. Afterwards, I was sent to Hastings. And that is the cadet school. Now, people don't realize that was Royal Flying Corps. But, of course, there was half a dozen of us went to Hastings. You had to do military law, field service regulations, internal economy, etiquette, how to be an officer. In addition to that, we had to do machine guns, which is an officer's job. And, of course, you had to learn topography, or map reading, and all that sort of thing. But that's the only time it sort of clashed. The army officers had to do machine guns and that thing. When I arrived at Hastings, we had an officer received us, you know, and he said, 3659 Private Tompkins. Sir, three paces forward. Stand perfectly still. And up walks a Major Wynne Wilson. He was the CO. He said, how much training have you done? I said, that's military training. I said, I've completed it, sir. He said, where's your home? I said, Bristol, sir. He said, I'm from Bristol myself. I can tell you a bit more about that later on. At any rate, he said, you'll be cadet group leader. It'll be your job to march the cadets to lectures and that sort of thing. He said, you go to the squadron office, I'll give you a lanyard to wear. So, did he know that I'm cadet group leader? I don't suppose it was any sort of official ranking, but it helped out, you see. Instead of having an officer to waste his time marching us to lecture, that was my job. And it wasn't easy, mind, Brad. I had to keep good order, mind. And of course, when we used to do PT, on the square, the public was coming to watch. And all the marching was left, 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 left. You know, I couldn't get the right end. It was all quick time stuff.
How many were in your group? How many were you in charge of?
Well, I suppose the school, it couldn't have been any more than perhaps 30 or 40, something like that. It wasn't a big school, you see. We were billeted in the Palace Hotel. It's quite a select place.
And, how many were you in charge of?
Well, I say about 20 or 30 like that. Well, say about 30, something like that. Exact figure I can't tell you, but we used to have to do an hour study every night in the big room in the Palace Hotel. It was a bit of a job to make sure they were all there, because we had an Italian cafe just down at the bottom. Of course, the Palace Hotel was built on the side of a cliff, so the back door is right up the top. It was like a penthouse at the top, see? At any rate, the first thing that I could report there, of course, I say I used to have to stand at the door while they were coming in for study. And if I saw there was empty chairs too many, I'd have to get a chap to dash down to Samadanis or Samadinas, Samadanis down the stairs, get them up, because, of course, study was compulsory, you see. But there's two events that happened there. We had a chap named Taylor. I said to this chap, Taylor, I said, Taylor, show a leg. He didn't take any notice. I repeated it. He didn't take any notice, so I whipped the clothes off him. And he squared up at me. I said, Taylor, I said, go down or it'll be RTU. Oh, that shook him. He begged me not to do any more about it. RT meant return to unit, because this is all military. Return to unit. That meant return to France. Well, I didn't do any more about it. He was a nice enough fellow. He was half asleep, you know, and he squared up at me. But there was a very amusing thing that happened there. We were in a penthouse, and the next flight down was the main building. And I looked in this other room in the penthouse. There was two. I had one to myself. These other three chaps had the other. And I looked in. They were looking out through the window. And I said, come on, chaps, get down. Quick. It seemed to be very hurried to get away. So I went to have a look through the window. And one of these chaps had a string with a fork on the end. And the cookhouse was underneath, and the cook had placed some cakes on the table. And he was going like this with a fork, trying to dig the fork into the cakes, lift the cakes up. Only for fun. And I was a bit amused about that. And then, of course, I had to take them up to Hampstead. You don't see much about this in records. That was for the medical.
So Hampstead was the medical centre?
That was the medical test, which was very stiff. That was from Hastings. Well, coming back, they gave me the